Our reading this morning is from the Gospel of John. Now, in Jerusalem, by the Sheep Gate, there is a pool called, in Hebrew, Bethesda, which has five porticos. In these lay many invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. One man was there who had been ill for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had been there a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be healed? Do you want to be healed?" The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, and while I am making my way, someone else steps down ahead of me." Jesus said to him, "Stand up. Take your mat and walk." And at once the man was made well, and he took up his mat and began to walk. So ends our reading. Do you want to be healed? Jesus asked the crippled man, no longer young, who had come every day to lie by the healing pool of Bethesda for 38 years, "Do you want to be healed?" What a question. What else would he be doing there? He had come through the Sheep Gate, part of the Golden Wall that still rings the old city of Jerusalem. It was once the place where they brought sheep into the temple to be sacrificed, so it had this aura of great holiness. And there were all kinds there, a great multitude of impotent folk, the King James Version says, of the blind, the halt, and the withered. They were waiting for something to happen. Something called the troubling of the water. And this expression comes from the belief that God or an angel would stir up or trouble the water in the pool. This expression also refers to the belief that the first one into the pool after the stirring happened, first one into the pool was cured completely and absolutely. And this wasn't just some idea that was cherished by a few delusional types, but believed by many, many people at the time. It was part of the culture. It was normal for them. And a great multitude gathered every day, hoping that that day it would be their turn. Can you imagine all the suffering collected in that one place? That, too, was simply part of the culture, normal. And so in the midst of all of this walks a man, whole and healthy, with no apparent need of the pool's curative powers at all. And the text doesn't say so, but it doesn't sound as if he came here by accident, or that this was just the most convenient route for him to take to his next appointment. I think Jesus went there on purpose. I see Jesus in these stories as a kind of healer, perhaps a combination medicine man, community organizer, and teacher, all within a very Jewish framework. He went there on purpose. He was going to work. And Rabbi Jesus picks out the sorriest man of the lot and asks this colossally stupid question, "Do you want to be healed?" It's a question really for everyone. All of us in one way or another have been experienced being broken. All of us have felt alone and hopeless at one time or another. Sometimes it drives people to come to church. Susan, who's a dear friend of mine back in Wilmington, once told me how it felt to be newly divorced. She was living in Dallas, which is a city that she hated. She had moved there for her husband's job, and now they were divorcing, and there she was, this native New Englander, feeling alone in this conservative, sweltering, foreign kind of place. And she decided to go to the Unitarian Universalist Church for a while. And at first, she said all she could do, she was so raw, all she could do was sit in the very back row and cry during the hymns. She ducked out early in the postlude so that she wouldn't have to talk to anyone. But just sitting there in that place with its music and its caring words was healing for her. And within a year, she was active in that church. She had found her people, the ones who had made life bearable. Sometimes it is just about bringing your body to the right place. And that's enough to start. We heal. But a real and lasting healing involves doing some work, doesn't it? It involves change. It involves giving up a lot of things that might be comfortable. Ask anybody who has type 2 diabetes, who the doctor has told time and time again to lose weight or you're going to die. Do you want to be healed? Do you need to be healed? No doubt, but do you want to be really? Of course I do, thought the lame man who was laying by the pool of mercy. But he doesn't say that. The lame man doesn't answer the question directly. When asked, do you want to be healed? He says, sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up. And while I'm making my way, someone else steps down ahead of me. His mind is racing ahead, you see. He assumes that his questioner, like everybody else, is wondering how he could be such a loser to come to the healing pool for 38 years and not be healed. He assumes that Jesus' real question is, what is wrong with you? Because surely God would have healed you by now if you were a good person. That was the common belief in those times. It was part of the culture. It was normal. And so this man has forgotten what it really was like to want to be healed, which means change. Now, I know a lot of Unitarian Universalists struggle with the Gospel of John because of the miracle healings. John, the writer of John, gives us a kind of super Jesus, the kind of God-man who can lift up a monster truck with one hand. And I don't know, you know, what exactly happened in the life of Rabbi Jesus, but I find it very plausible that crowds did gather around him, the way that they do for anyone whose presence seems healing. An example today, I think, would be the Dalai Lama. I think the Dalai Lama would probably laugh his head off if you said he was God, by the way. But I also think Jesus would have, too. He knew, as does any great leader or teacher, healer or shaman, that you have to want to be healed. You have to work for it. You don't just sit around, take up your bed and walk. I know change is hard, I hear him saying, but let me just ask you, do you want to be healed? Pina Rosenberg is a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, and she writes about the enormous difficulty people have with change. Even changing things that we know will kill us. Drinking, overeating, smoking. You smoke, she says. And someone comments, and you tell him, you're not hooked. You can quit any time. And he doesn't believe it. But the funny thing is, you believe it. A smoker, she says, makes a choice to perform an act 20 times a day that is likely to cause him or her serious illness and very possibly a premature death. And that fact is intolerable. So the mind does tricks, she says, to make it more tolerable. We rationalize things, we repress them, we deny them, easily, fluidly, without even knowing we're doing it. Children forget trauma from their childhoods, though they suffer greatly as adults without knowing why. People suffering in a marriage can do this also, my friend Susan tells me. Tolerate the intolerable, because change is so frightening. And in doing this, we become helpless to act on our own behalf. We don't change. And this sort of thing happens in whole cultures. The intolerable becomes normal for everyone. Tina Rosenberg went to South Africa to study the AIDS epidemic. There were massive public health campaigns there at the time she went that were giving young people a lot of information about the dangers of unprotected sex and multiple partners. There were long lectures that they had to sit through, and there were these big, scary billboard ads that gave gruesome statistics and talked about the very real possibility that your behavior could mean your early death and the passing of the disease along to your children. And virtually none of this had any effect on the young people that it was aimed at. None. Why? Well, because taking in information and taking in frightening images and stories about what could happen to us if we don't change doesn't change us. Information by itself doesn't move us. Fear makes us dive under the covers even deeper. Our ability to assume that it's all about somebody else and not me is immense. So none of the AIDS prevention campaigns worked in South Africa. Just as here in the U.S., none of the anti-smoking ad campaigns worked. None of them lowered teen smoking. It's hard to believe we would care for our lives so little that we wouldn't want to be healed. Of course, there are other forces at work here, in addition to the human inability to do something inconvenient or uncomfortable, like losing weight or going through nicotine withdrawal. Other forces join in. There's a profit motive. Tobacco companies loved the anti-smoking ads for young people. Some of them helped to even sponsor them. Why? Because they predicted correctly that they wouldn't work. They put the Surgeon General's warning on cigarettes because they had to. And to their immense relief, people ignored it completely. They knew that advertising and warnings did nothing to change people's habits, nor did it change their desire to belong in the case of the youth, to belong and to be like their friends who were smoking. And then you can have a whole culture that says something like this: smoking, dangerous sex, eating something called the Baconator, becomes acceptable and normal. Everybody's doing it. We tolerate the intolerable. For millennia, we have been a species that needs to be accepted. We need to be accepted by other people. Our sort of hermit, individualistic approach to life is really quite recent. Our brains have not caught up. And we've just forgotten how much we need to belong. Many of our brain functions actually still have to do with getting along in a group, with surviving, helping us to fit in still. We just don't know it, nor do we know all the things that we tolerate in order to survive in a culture. They become kind of invisible to us. You can have an entire culture then that may be racist or sexist, homophobic, or violent, and not really realize it. Unless, of course, these things come at your expense. We not only say that these things are okay, but they come as part of the package. They come as part of our freedom as Americans to do all of these things. It's our right. It's our right to carry a gun, any gun, including a semi-automatic weapon with a high magazine load. A sacred right for some people. Do you want to be healed from these things as a society? And collectively, I think we're not so sure. But we feel the symptoms of it. We feel the illness, the emptiness and the separation and the loneliness that comes with all of these things. Do you ever feel that yourself? Do you want to be healed? Healing of individuals and of the world, actually, is the business of people of faith. It is a religious experience, actually, to feel the illness of a culture, to be willing to feel that illness and become unwilling to tolerate it. It's a religious impulse, the desire to heal people, to heal the world. Tikkun HaOlam is the Jewish expression and the biggest aim of Judaism, the repair of the broken world. This is why Buddhists meditate, to cultivate loving kindness and why Christians and sometimes Unitarian Universalists tell inspiring stories about Jesus and others who have immense compassion. We see sickness and suffering in the world, and we want to be among the helpers, the people who bring about healing, and we don't quite know how. So if giving people information and scaring them doesn't bring about change or healing, if they prove to be just as ineffective as laying by a pool of water and waiting for the angel to come, what does work? Well, coming together and finding joy, I say. Coming together and finding joy. And letting that joy be infectious. Being around joyful people who are doing the things that we admire and having a good time doing it. Tina Rosenberg found in her work as a journalist that she seemed to be following basically the same story all around the world. She was following a story about people who made amazing changes in their lives and in the lives of others. And the thing that usually tipped the situation, tipped the change in situation after situation, was positive peer pressure. Positive peer pressure. In our desperate need to belong, positive peer pressure, our need to belong, can all be bent toward the good. So in South Africa, there was a brilliant public health effort that seized on this notion of peer pressure and created a whole new approach. They created an ad campaign that was called Love Life, appropriately, but it also meant loving life. And it included hip images of young people who seemed to know something. They were smart, hip young women who were making good choices. They were strong. Others wanted to be like them. And Love Life was an ad campaign, but it was also a social club, a group of people that were all making this choice together. A lot of they would enlist these teens to start groups all over the country. And they would have these gatherings that really had nothing to do with sex education or AIDS, but it had everything to do with doing what was cool, what the in crowd was doing. And young people joined these clubs and experienced a new kind of belonging. She found this approach working in all kinds of places, in all kinds of situations, with all kinds of seemingly intractable problems. Latino kids in high schools all over the U.S., who were failing dramatically at math and science, were helped by people like themselves who were making it cool to do calculus. Women in Indian villages became healers and people of stature in spite of their bottom level in the caste system. She found this peer pressure in drab little meeting rooms all over the world, church basements, little clubhouses, people healing each other from addiction. It's called Alcoholics Anonymous. And all the anonymous programs where people heal one another operate on this power of belonging. It's called the social cure. She calls it the social cure, and it works on adults as well as on youth. We all need to belong. Find a healthy people to belong to. Live among those people who no longer tolerate the intolerable. And you have a chance yourself. Do you ever wonder what happens to people who have a kind of a deep conversion experience, who are born again? They say it changes their lives. And their lives are changed. I've seen it. I've seen people take on responsibility that they wouldn't before, feed the hungry, take in the stranger. How does it happen? What happens with hundreds of men who convert to Islam when they are in prison and manage to give up a life of violence and drugs to follow the Prophet? Now, it's not clear to me how much the presence of Jesus or the presence of Muhammad are part of this. experiencing a divine presence is a highly individual thing, and it doesn't really translate to everyone else. But what we can see is that in such conversions, a whole community starts to spring up around the new person. People who love them. They now have a group of people who care about them. And that has a mighty influence on the choices that they make. When my friend Susan first walked into a UU church that was alive, she saw right away she wanted to be like those people. She wanted what they had. I saw it myself the first time. There was a light in people's eyes that had gone out in mine. A light that had gone dead through suffering, through loneliness. We come to church because something inside of us has gone dead. Something inside of us has stopped caring about healing or caring about the world. We've tolerated the intolerable too long. We have lost joy. But UU churches, yours and mine, are filled with people who are potential healers, all of us. They're filled with people who practice inclusiveness, welcome, hospitality, compassion, working for social justice. People who believe that our shared purpose in life is love, and they want to practice it. Friedrich Buechner once said that your purpose comes from finding the place where your deep gladness meets the world's deep needs. Your deep gladness meets the world's deep needs. And a UU church community is a powerful source of deep gladness, meeting a deep need. And there are critical moments when we really become aware of that. In December, the Sunday after the terrible shootings in Newtown, churches were full of people who wanted to be healed all across America, including ours. Now, some churches put aside the topic that they had planned to have for the day, and they addressed the shooting head-on in a sermon. At my church in Chicago, it just happened to be the day of our holiday pageant, and we had to honor the children's hard work. We didn't have a choice. They were so excited. But what a balm it was to our souls to honor the worth and dignity of our children, of all children, that day. We needed the deep gladness of seeing our children in their costumes, of our youth string quartet. They were in their serious black suits and black dresses, sitting up straight, and they sounded exquisite, and we needed them. I don't know about you, but when we were first hearing about what had happened in Newtown, hearing the grim stories and hearing the names and seeing the school pictures, I think it was the school pictures that did it to me. All of those little faces, I could barely stand it. I could only take a little sip of information at a time, and then I had to stop. If that, all by itself, if that alone, information, was all that I had to go on, I don't think I would have done anything. I think I would have curled up. We do. We curl up. It's so awful. It was the joy of those little children on that Sunday. Giddy dancing snowflakes, girls dressed in these kind of glamorous angel costumes, dancing toy goats and elephants, tough boys dressed up as germs. They were handing out these paper germs. Our pageant was a little weird that year, but it was good. It was really good. It was a balm to our souls. And it was that pageant that got me going again. That was the thing that helped me to face this thing with my community. And we started to write letters and speak out about gun violence in ways that we had not had the courage to do before. It's an exciting time in our country. It's just beginning. And it's exciting to be a part of this time. Now, I know that on a Sunday morning, many people come to church for the sermon, right? It's going to be a good sermon. What's it about? We put a lot of focus on the sermon every week in church, especially Unitarian Universalists. But if all you do, really, if all you do is listen to the sermon, no matter how compelling it is, you may as well just be going to a movie. You are far more likely to really do something, to actually change something, if you make friends here. If you start hanging out with people that live the way that you want to live, people you admire and want to be like, people who you care what they think about you. If you see people who are living more joyfully, doing more service, who are out in the world, witnessing against injustice, giving their time in service, and finding a deep gladness in doing it, your chances go way up of your doing it yourself. If you really want your life to change, you need to find your people here, the ones who will inspire you. We can find joy in our church, in teaching RE, in choir practice, in doing public witness, in doing committee meetings. Yes, boring committee meetings can have joy if they serve a deep purpose. Joy is everywhere in our church. It's in the light coming through the windows. It's in the faces that you recognize and the new faces that you are so thrilled to see here for the first time, in the sweet sounds and in the voices. And we find it in public witness. I was so excited to read about the things this church is doing. Just starting to look at UU legislative ministry for churches in Virginia. In Virginia? How cool is that? It's a wonderful time to be here. So much joy. We've just begun to change the conversation about gun violence in this country, which I had never thought was possible. Hallelujah. It's exciting, and the work has just begun. We need the deep gladness of our faith now more than ever to carry us forward. We are the healing of the world. Amen.
We come to this place because we love what exists here. This church is a living entity, and like all living things, it must have nurture and sustenance. Its breath and its heartbeat, its life itself, can only be derived from its living components, us. An offering will now be made to support us and received in love.